We want to welcome you this evening. I'm David Fritzy, executive editor of Oklahoma Watch. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Oklahoma Watch, but it's a nonprofit news organization. We produce in-depth and investigative journalism on important public policy issues in the state. Our mission is to dig beneath the surface of these policy issues and promote civic discussion of them. If you would like to learn more about Oklahoma Watch, please sign up to receive our weekly newsletter at the table outside or go online to oklahomawatch.org. Tonight we'll be discussing how Oklahoma City Police relate to and communicate with and serve those within the African American and Hispanic communities with our two guests, Oklahoma City Councilman John Pettis Jr. and Oklahoma City Police Chief Bill City. Before we dive into questions, I'll explain a little how. First, I'd like to thank our partners. One of them is DeCamp's 1910 Cafe for donating this event space, and to KGOU Radio for providing their audio expertise. KGOU will rebroadcast tonight's program, so you can check their website for dates and times. Our format is simple. It's simply question and answer. I'll begin by moderating the discussion, asking some questions, and then we'll be turning it over to you to ask questions. We have two people roaming the audience this evening. Jenny Nygren, holding her hand up, and Victor Henderson up here. So when I give you a cue, you can raise your hand and ask questions. And the only thing we ask is you try to keep your questions fairly short. We're trying to cover a lot of ground in 1 hour, and certainly there'll be opinions among you, but if you could, again, keep those questions and those views as short as possible so we can get to as many questions as possible. Let's get started. I would like to direct our first question to Police Chief City. Over the past year, for police, really, and for the nation, it's been one shocking, deadly scene after another. Michael Brown in Ferguson, Walter Scott in Charleston, Eric Garner on Staten Island, Eric Harris in Tulsa. All of these have led to grave doubts among many about the policing of America's streets, especially in Black and Hispanic communities. I would like to ask if you think those doubts run deep in minority neighborhoods in Oklahoma City, what's the relationship like?
Well, I think there's no doubt that those thoughts and feelings run deep among all the minority community at this time in our history. We've always struggled with minority relationships to a certain extent. And because of just historically, it's always been an uphill battle, that distrust of law enforcement. And it's with the African-American community as well as the Hispanic community. But I think a lot of the things that have happened now as a result of the video, as a result of, phones and, those types of videos being published of officers' actions, it's kind of twofold. You've seen some things that are just, there's no doubt, there's no question that the police responded irresponsibly, that they did not handle the situation appropriately, that in some cases it's actually been criminal, as we've seen in a lot of the filings. But I think that there's the other side of that too, is there's some things that have been captured that are probably appropriate police actions that may not look good to the general public, not knowing some of the things that law enforcement has to deal with on a regular basis, some use of force issues and those types of things. So I think there's a lot of concern, obviously, and I think some of it is founded. I think some of it is probably not founded. But regardless, the perception, whether it's real or it's unreal, in this case I think it's both, I think it's affected the nation as a whole, not just in those locations where that's occurred, but also in places like Oklahoma. And that's why it's important to have these discussions and try to talk through some of these issues.
Councilman Pettis, what's your view? How would you characterize the relationship between Northeast Oklahoma City and the police department?
First of all, thank you, Oklahoma Watch, for putting on this event this evening. All across the country, there has been this discussion of police and minority communities. And I'm definitely glad we are having this discussion tonight. We must face the fact that historically, the police for years on top of years was used to intimidate African Americans for years on top of years. You look at during the Civil Rights Movement, the police was used to, again, and a lot of cases used to intimidate African Americans. I think the city of Oklahoma City has definitely come a long way in regards to relationship between the African American community and the police department, but there is definitely still room for more growth. So I definitely, again, believe that the relationship is better now than years ago, but it's not the best. And Chief and his staff are working along with different community organizations to get it to be the best, but right now we are just not there quite yet.
Chief, what about officers? What do they say about some of this national criticism? What's their view? Do they feel they're being second-guessed? Do they feel that people just don't know the risks and the hard choices they have to make?
Well, I think it's really a mixed bag. I mean, I think that there's a lot of officers that they understand what the issues are, because in many cases it's not something new. I mean, they've been questioned in the past. Their scrutiny in law enforcement on law enforcement is significant. You know, the difference you have now is that it's on video. I mean, you see those types of things, and in trying to explain your actions, officers have always had to be responsible in explaining why they did things, whether it's to us, to the community, to the media, or in the courts in dealing with lawsuits. So it's really nothing new, and I think that, you know, they've had to deal with it in the past. I think it's much more significant now. I think the criticism is much greater, and I think that officers are concerned that they're not getting that support. I think that overall they were concerned with that, and I don't know how you could avoid them feeling that way with what's going on. But at the same time, if you talk to a lot of officers, they're just as critical of what they're seeing officers do in most cases as the general public is, because for the most part, officers want to do what's right and do what's right, and in dealing with a lot of the human tragedy and a lot of the issues that they have to deal with on a daily basis. And they're probably, in some ways, a lot tougher on officers that don't handle themselves appropriately than the general public is. At the same time, I see this community in Oklahoma City come together and support police officers, go out of their way to support law enforcement and the officers out in the field more than they have before, because they're aware of what's going on in the community and the criticism that police are taking.
Councilman, what do your constituents say about police and police activities in their neighborhood? What do you hear?
A lot of times what you hear the good and the bad. You hear the stories that I was pulled over because I was black, but you also hear the stories of the police officer who helped save someone's life. So you, in Northeast Oklahoma City, again, you hear the good and you also hear the bad. We must admit that there are some good officers, and we also must admit that there are some officers who may not want to be or should be officers anymore. So I hear both sides of the situation. Even though I am a councilman, I am African American, and so I know what it's like to drive through a particular neighborhood, and when you see a police officer behind you, this all types of things run through your head, and that's something that, you know, most African American males we think about, but as the councilman, I hear a lot of positive stories about the police, but then you do hear those stories that are not positive.
So you grew up in Northeast Oklahoma City.
I grew up in Northeast Oklahoma City, still live in Northeast Oklahoma City. I stay in Parker Estates neighborhood, and in Parker Estates neighborhood you have the Spring Lake Division. In the Spring Lake Division, Major Jennings, is doing a excellent job in the Spring Lake Division. And so in my neighborhood, you see police officers all the time.
Were growing up, or even more recently, were you ever stopped because you feel the color of your skin?
Growing up, keep in mind, I'm black and big. And if you look at some of the different stories that you hear about stereotypes, at any given time, I may fit one of those stereotypes, or I may fit one of those racially profiling tools that's sometimes been used in the past. Do I feel that I've been pulled over because of my race? There are some municipalities where I do admit that I am afraid to drive through at night. And here it is, 2015, and you still have that feeling. But, you know, that feeling goes back, you know, generations on top of generations. And, you know, I think we will come to a point where young African-American males won't feel that way anymore. But, you know, what's going on now in our country, you can't help but to think about whether or not you was pulled over because of your race.
Chief, about 15% or so of Oklahoma City is African American, and correct me if I'm wrong, about 6% of the department or officers are African American. What are you doing to try and increase those percentages?
Well, that's always been a challenge. This isn't a new challenge. I think what's going on right now makes it a little bit more difficult, because I think, you know, that distrust, you know, and that gap between law enforcement and the minority communities is greater as a result that's going on. But it's always been a challenge. You know, we do our best to try to portray at least the officers that we have within our department, try to get them out in the community and really have the community try to work with us in trying to recruit, you know, good applicants into the police department that are minorities, because we do need to have a better representation. You know, I've always said, whether it's a female, Hispanic, African American, is we need that input because it differs. I don't think the same way as a female might. I don't think about those things, and I don't think as an African American, I don't think what might affect them and culturally those things that might affect them. We need that within the department to be better, but we also need that so that we have that, at least have a perception within the department that we're representing the community that we serve. So we're doing things through social media. We're doing a lot more through social media, because that's how a lot of young people now are looking for jobs and are finding out what's available out there. So we're doing a lot more. We use our African-American or our minority officers in a lot of ways, and we use our females to try to actually go out and promote the police department in and of itself.
Councilman, do you think that would make a difference if there were more officers who were black patrolling in black neighborhoods? Or, I mean, it almost sounds simplistic, but maybe it would make
You know, I get that question a lot, because if you, again, you brought up 5%, 6%, 5% or 6% of the population is black as it relates to the police officers. If you look at what patrols Northeast Oklahoma City, and you have a large number of Caucasians who patrol Northeast Oklahoma City, I think to some degree it definitely would help if we had more African American officers, without question. I think it helps. One thing I definitely do want to touch on that Chief has not touched on yet, this year or last year, the city, we started a cadet program with Metro Tech, where Metro Tech has juniors and seniors in high school who go through their program, and it teaches them how to be a law enforcement officer. And I looked at, as a matter of fact, I spent half of the day yesterday watching that cadet program. And when I looked in the cadet program, the vast majority of the students who were in the cadet program, I looked, they were Hispanics. Then you had a few who were Caucasians, then you had two who were African-American, and one of the reasons why the chief and one of the sergeants really wanted to start the program was to get more young people to think about careers in law enforcement. One of the things that I think that from a community standpoint, I think we, as African Americans, we really should lead the campaign to get more minorities involved in law enforcement. Now, oftentimes we complain that we don't have enough black officers, but we have not really strongly did a hardcore push to start working with the younger generation and even people who get out of military for them to look into going into law enforcement. So one of the issues that I do plan on doing is finding a way how can we really increase the number of African Americans who are in law enforcement. You think about it, African Americans, we have approximately between 70 to 80 black police officers, and in a few years they'll be able, a vast majority of those officers will be able to retire. So that scares me, because you have maybe 80, then if half of them retire, we'll have 40. So I definitely believe that there has to be, from the community level, some responsibility to really push to get more African Americans to think about going into the field of law enforcement, because we have a lot of churches in Northeast Oklahoma City. And imagine if each church got one person to even think about being in law enforcement, what type of increase will we have a year from now, 2 years from now, or 5 years from now? I look at the cadet program, and I see in maybe 5 to 10 years, the Hispanic population is going to outnumber the African Americans for as how many Hispanic and black officers we have. I definitely, looking at that cadet program, right, there will be more Hispanic officers than African American officers.
Mm-hmm. Chief, the Washington Post, as well as another large newspaper, have been trying to count officer-involved shootings because they found that many are just not reported to the federal government. And they've been using social media and nonprofit groups and anyone who reports it, newspaper clippings. They looked at the first 5 months of 2015 and found about 365 fatalities. And they had Oklahoma as a state at a 4.4 rate, highest in the nation. Are too many officers killing people in Oklahoma? And do you think there are too many officer-involved shootings in your department?
I think one's too many. I mean, if you're going to ask me how many's too many, yeah, I don't like to see any. But the fact is that deadly force is a necessary part of law enforcement. You know, and there's usually, and I tell people, there's a correlation between an officer being confronted with a firearm and an officer having to use deadly force. And I think officers are coming across firearms more and more and more, and especially in areas like Oklahoma, southern states are dealing with this much more than say other parts of the country are. The officer-involved shootings are higher. And in most cases, if you look at major city policies, now I can't speak for all the rural areas and all those other types of, you know, state agencies, but in your major police departments, most of the procedures and policies and requirements for the use of deadly force are pretty much the same. You know, but as far as what the officers deal with out in the field, I can tell you when I started this job 38 years ago, you know, I worked some of the toughest areas of Oklahoma City my first 3 years. And I maybe took one gun off of somebody in maybe 3 or 4 weeks. Officers are doing that every week. Officers are doing that every night. They're running warrants and they're getting a cache of firearms. They're confronted with firearms that they're having to deal with people that have firearms or carrying firearms. It used to be unheard of, at least when I was a young officer, you never had a burglar carry a firearm. It's not unusual now for somebody breaks into your house and they're carrying a firearm in the process of that. So, you know, there's a correlation between what they're having to deal with and having to use deadly force. Are there times where I think that, you know, it's a little bit questionable? Sure, I do. I mean, there's some tough decisions that have to be made, both by myself and by the district attorney in reviewing those cases for possible charges. But at the same time, I'm telling you, I open up our significant incident every morning, and I can tell you I'm amazed at the restraint officers have had in a lot of cases where they have not used deadly force, and they were perfectly justified in doing so.
A number of them, in that particular count, a number of them were involved unarmed suspects,
right.
but in which situations escalated. But, Councilman, what's your sense of how big of an issue this is for your community?
Well, my community, we think about what happened in Ferguson. We think about what is happening nationally. You mentioned about the national statistics. There's one report from an online organization that said if you are African American male in Oklahoma, you are 6 times likely to get shot in the state of Oklahoma than you are in Georgia. And so a lot of people who live in Northeast Oklahoma City, who drive through Northeast Oklahoma City, I mean, a lot of that stuff goes through our mind. And so, I mean, I see what the community goes through because, like I said, I live in Northeast Oklahoma City. So, I mean, I see some of the fear because of what has happened nationally. We talk about what happened in Oklahoma City. There's been some cases where I was like, what? And when you hear about a police officer shooting somebody, as a African American male, I think, oh, was he black? But that's just reality that as a African American male, I mean, you ask yourself those type of questions. Some of the shootings were more than likely justified. You know, if you're running from a police officer and you have a gun, and you know. That's a tough call for a police officer. But then you do have some cases where individuals may not have been armed but got killed. So it is a very tough call.
Before I turn it over to the audience, I had one follow-up for the chief. And there was a conference, there are probably many conferences in law enforcement, a few months ago, sponsored by the Police Education Research Forum. And they came out with an opinion, an essay, an opinion piece, findings, and a couple of things they said. They said that we need to rethink the training that police officers receive on de-escalation strategies and tactics. We sometimes find that while the shooting may be legally justified, there were missed opportunities to ratchet down the encounter, to slow things down, to call in additional resources in the minutes before the shooting occurred. And they have a number of other recommendations. I think several of your officers attended this conference. And they also point to what's going on in other countries and suggest a number of other moves that could be taken. And they say that a number of cities such as Seattle, San Diego, half a dozen to 8 cities are seriously reevaluating their use of force policies. Are you looking at any changes in your use of force policies?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been at a couple of those meetings, those PERF. I'm a member of PERF, and attended those. And what you just described is exactly some of the comments that came out of the meetings we went with. And I want to say this about what's going on in this country. The things that are happening right now can be really positive. I think that law enforcement has to constantly look at itself. Law enforcement has to evolve. Their policies, their procedures, there's a lot of things that you have to constantly look at, whether it's training or whether you need to change your use of force policies. And some of the things that are coming out, some of these things that are being brought out now forces law enforcement to really look at itself. And that's what it's really done. I mean, what has happened has really forced law enforcement to look at ourselves and say, you know, are we? There's a thing that came out of the 21st century policing, which is called procedural justice. Are our procedures appropriate? Are they developed so that we're treating people fairly? Do we approach things fairly? Do we approach somebody we're writing a ticket fairly? That's procedural justice. Do we treat people the way they should be treated, or are we doing things that escalate a situation? We've already started de-escalation training. We started it as a result of an incident that occurred before Ferguson even occurred, and we started the development of de-escalation. Because I totally agree with, right now, we need to be evaluating incidents not just on the fact of what happened in that moment, but how officers are tactically leading up to that. Could they have done some things better? Could they have slowed things down? Could they have received backup? Could they have, you know, tactically done things? Because what we're trying to impress upon our officers now, and a lot of it has to be through training, and where we're really focusing right now is on our training. And we have to train our officers to have the mindset that we want the best possible outcome of any incident. It's not whether whether we're there with a highly volatile suspect with a firearm or whether we're there to protect a victim. We want the best possible outcome because we don't want to have to take the life of anyone, and we don't want the life of anyone taken. So what can we do? How can we train our officers mentally in cases where you can, because there's times where you can't slow things down. There's times when they're called to a situation that's very dynamic, very volatile, and you're asking that officer to go in and make some tough decisions quickly or somebody's life may be in jeopardy. But there are many times where an officer doesn't have to do that. They may be able to wait for backup. They may be able to do some of those things. You know, most of the officers that have shot and killed somebody that are unarmed has been in a physical confrontation where a person has allegedly overpowered the officer in the process of that. Officers are very, you know, they're very aware of the fact their firearm could be taken away from them. They're very aware of the fact they could be beaten to death. And it doesn't necessarily mean that if somebody doesn't have a firearm, they're not a lethal threat to an officer. And I think that has to be taken in consideration at times. But in a lot of those situations, we want to make sure our officers are making good decisions going into it so that we can have the best possible outcome. So I think what's going on is a very positive thing for law enforcement. I think the scrutiny is always, we're always under scrutiny. But I've always said that about the media. You know, people, you know, we complain about the media sometimes, no offense. But it really helps us. It forces us to think about things and make some decisions on things that we may have procrastinated on or may have just not taken the initiative to do. So, I mean, the response is, yes, I agree. The 21st century policing that came out, I think, is a very good document. I think it's something that we're really reviewing and looking at things. There's things that we do. But I think there's a lot of those things that we can do better, and then some of the things that we don't do, then we need to look at doing them to try to make us a better police department.
Open it up to the audience for questions. We have one back here.
Yes, Diane McDaniel, JFK area. Thank you. Chief City, are you all doing cultural diversity with the officers? And secondly, we had Officer Huff in the JFK area. And he was our policeman. He came to various meetings, and all of a sudden, Spring Lake officers weren't in our area. We had people from Santa Fe coming to patrol. So when we were developing a rapport, the neighbors were getting used to Officer Huff, and all of a sudden, poof, gone. So why should Santa Fe patrol JFK, especially in the off of 13th, 10th, 6th?
Right. Well, the reason there's a easy explanation for that is we changed our districts. We actually redesigned our boundaries. So 10th Street is now the boundary. So everything south of 10th Street is now part of Santa Fe, and everything north of 10th Street is going to be Spring Lake. So that's why you didn't see Huff. You actually have Santa Fe officers that are responsible for that district, anything south of 10th Street. And yes, diversity training has always been a part of the Oklahoma City Police Department. We've been doing that for years. In fact, we actually had the Department of Justice come in with one of their programs prior to Ferguson. Actually, we had it was after Ferguson, but we had scheduled it and planned it with the Department of Justice to come in and put on their program, their racial profiling and their diversity program prior to that ever happening. And that happened shortly after Ferguson. That was the last diversity bias training that we had actually received. So, but we are constantly doing diversity training.
Other questions? There's one.
Hi, Chief City. My name is Austin Sims, and I'll try to make this short. I used to work in law enforcement many years ago, and the establishment that I worked at, I noticed that there was kind of a good old boy type of culture where a lot of my colleagues would pressure each other into acting in ways that were not appropriate and that they would not normally act had they been an individual. And I'm wondering what steps that the Oklahoma City Police is taking to prevent a culture like that from happening, and what kind of support do officers who disagree with their colleagues' actions have?
I didn't catch the last part of that question.
What kind of support do officers who disagree with other officers' action, what kind of support do they have in holding their coworkers accountable?
Right. Well, obviously, when we go through training and we bring new officers in, part of our policies and procedures are require them to report anything, any misconduct or anything that they think may be amount to misconduct. Otherwise, they can be disciplined for not reporting those types of things. You're right. The hard part is getting them to report those types of things, because there is a lot of peer pressure. And I'm not going to say that officers don't overlook things that other officers do in some cases. I like to think that they don't overlook real serious incidents. I mean, we've had officers that have reported other officers that have overstepped their bounds in the use of force and things like that. Officers that have lied or been dishonest about some information at arrest. Most of that stuff that we get, and we have some ongoing right now, have come from internally. Most of those types of things have come in from internal officers, from officers within the department. So I'm not going to say that everything is reported, but we try to create an environment, an atmosphere, and a lot of that we can talk it, but we got to walk it also. When it does happen, we have to make those types of decisions so they know how serious we take those. Lying in the police department, I told 12 years ago when I came in as chief, I put a directive out. The first thing I said was, if you lie in an investigation of any type, then you'll be terminated. No ifs, ands, or buts. Lying was dishonesty was not appropriate. So, we try to set that standard, and we try to do the training to address that. Some of that's still going to happen, but it's, you're right. I mean, it's kind of innate to a culture. Officers depend on other officers really for their life, and so they become a bond. They become very close, and sometimes they overlook some things that they shouldn't. But I can also promise you that I like to think that a lot of the real, real serious issues are reported.
A question in back.
Thank you. My name is Dorsine Swagner-Littles, Professor Emeritus from the University of Oklahoma. I'm going to make a blank statement. Every person in America is raised to be biased or prejudiced, and it is implicit. Many people are not aware of their bias or prejudice. There's a test online developed by Harvard University called the Implicit Bias Test, and it is particularly significant for the police department because it explains why so many of the encounters between minority communities and the police end up in a deadly force, whereas the same action taken by a Caucasian with the police department does not end up in a deadly force. I challenge everyone in this room to go online and take that test. I had to take it 3 times before I got an acceptable score because I myself am prejudiced. I'm asking the question During the diversity training, do you directly address bias and prejudice that is implicit in most people, particularly Caucasians? But as I mentioned, everyone is biased. I was taught to be biased toward Native Americans, Hispanics, white Americans, Asian Americans because of stereotypes. And every other group is taught the same thing. But, and it makes our interactions with each other sometimes tense and strained, and we are suspicious of each other.
So your question would be, does the diversity training address specifically racial discrimination and acting on those biases, even subconsciously?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the classes we had actually has a program in it that shows officers what their biases are, and shows, you know, based on how people look, based on, we had a really good one involving specifically juveniles and how juveniles dress or the color of their skin, and you know, not that we tried to embarrass officers in training, because that would be counterproductive, but the officers, and if you took that and you went through that training, you knew, you saw what, it showed you what your bias was in one situation where it wouldn't have been in the other. And so you're absolutely right. We grow up and we develop biases as we grow up. And the important thing is to know that we have them and to deal with them. But, and you're absolutely right, we've tried to do that with a lot of our diversity training and a lot of that. But, and I think that's very important. So I had a point here to make and I forgot what it was. But it's really important for officers to know what their biases are so that they can deal with it. If you don't know what they are, because I remember asking our chief when he was chief, M.T. Berry, our first black police chief. I remember just sitting around in discussion one day and I said, you know, I don't see, you know, the bias or the prejudice, you know, from my standpoint against African Americans. Do you ever feel like, you know, you're being discriminated against? And it took him a second to say, absolutely all the time. If I'm looking for a house or if I'm going shopping, and here's my chief, police chief, who I have a lot of respect for, you know, it just kind of wakes you up that it's there. I mean, it's not, and that's why it's important for us within the department to have diversity within that department to help make us aware of those types of things too. Now we do have policies and procedures in place that you cannot discriminate. So we can all have that bias. The important thing is that you don't discriminate or use that bias in the decisions you make with the general public that we serve.
Councilman Pettis, I'd like to ask you, We did a project with students at OU, and we went into Northeast Oklahoma City, South Oklahoma City too, and did interviews with residents, mobile videos. And we heard some people talk about how they felt like there were too many police officers watching them or looking for an opportunity to stop them, or they were being questioned when they had no real reason. By the same token, we talked with others who said, police need to respond more quickly. We need more patrols. So you have this tension. What are your thoughts on the balance of police presence in Northeast Oklahoma City?
You know, there has to be a balance. I have some neighborhoods in Northeast Oklahoma City that they want more of a police presence. Then I have other neighborhoods who say, well, we have too many police officers, you know. So it's trying to find that common balance, and I think the Major Jennings has done an excellent job of trying to address whether or not we have enough officers or we don't have enough officers, because I get those calls all the time asking for extra patrol. Then I get those calls that said, hey, we have too many patrol officers. So, I mean, you do have to try to find a balance.
Can I respond to that? Do you mind?
Go ahead, sure.
Here's part of the balance. For me, as a police chief, part of that balance is when I'm having a large number of shootings or killings in a certain area, I have a responsibility to keep people from dying. And that's my balance. We don't just inundate an area with law enforcement for no reason. And the reality of it is, the reality here is that the African-American community in general makes up a disproportional percentage of our low-income population. They also make up a disproportionate percentage of our gang activity. With gang activity comes violence. That's part of the culture. With gang activity becomes firearms, drug dealings, that type of thing. And they exist in certain neighborhoods. And I have a responsibility, the police department has a responsibility to try to keep people from dying. And so the responsibility for us when we do take initiatives in certain areas where we put more police officers in certain areas, because it's all data-driven. Police work these days is all data-driven. Where the crime occurs, where those things are occurring, is where we try to put some more resources to be able to deal with those issues. So our responsibility is to make sure that we communicate what we're doing with the community. We need, in many cases, we need to do a better job of communicating and talking to the community where we're going to be in, because they're going to have more traffic stops. There's going to be innocent people that aren't committing violent crimes stopped as a result of a traffic violation or some of those types of things, just the mere fact that we have more officers in that area. But it's right. There is a balance, but the one balance that occurs that outweighs others is keeping people safe and saving lives. So,
and I'm definitely glad that you touched up on that balance of keeping people safe. And I'm happy to report, because of the job of Chief City and Major Jennings and so many others, crime is actually down in Northeast Oklahoma City. A lot of times the media portrays that crime is awfully high in Northeast Oklahoma City, but crime is down. Am I correct, Chief?
Correct, it is.
Other questions? Back there. You have one there. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead here first.
Councilman, if a citizen files a complaint against the police department, he has to file a affidavit stating he would be willing to take a lie detector test. Why does not the officer involved have to do the same thing?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
You could speak a little louder, please.
If the Oklahoma City Police if you file a complaint against the Oklahoma City Police, you have to file a deal and have it notarized that you will take a lie detector test. You're willing to. But the officer is not required to. Why is that?
Very good question.
Want me to answer that?
Yes.
The reality of that is that we don't ever make a citizen take a lie detector test. They're not. They can be questionable at times, and in and of themselves, they're not. You can't use those really to determine whether or not an officer's lying or a citizen's lying. So I have never, ever, ever had a citizen. We investigate all incidents regardless. Regardless of whether you'll take. Most people don't file a formal complaint where that information's on there, and you're probably right. It's probably dated and needs to be removed, because we never use it. We investigate those complaints and don't require a citizen to take those.
We had a question back here from this gentleman. If you can get a microphone to him, if you raise your hand. Thank you.
With Oklahoma being ranked number one and number two per capita as far as killings by police officers, New York is the only state in the entire country that has special prosecutors for all police killings. Do you all support a special prosecutor for the state of Oklahoma, being that we're number one or two in the nation killing by police officers?
Yes.
Does anyone want to elaborate on that?
You're looking at me. You know, I don't oppose that. I think that I support having more discussions about ways of doing that. If it will increase the public's trust in their law enforcement, which I don't think it necessarily will, but if perception wise, if that would increase, you know, that trust, I think it's something that needs to be discussed. I know a lot of states have passed laws that require independent prosecutors, that require independent investigations by other outside law enforcement agencies, instead of having the agency investigate basically its own shooting and its own officers. I understand people thinking that would make things a lot better. I question that it would, but I won't sit here and say I'm completely opposed to that at this point. I think it deserves discussion as to how it would be better and what entities would actually be responsible for that if it did occur. Pardon? Right, but the problem is you're still going to have prosecutors that are associated with law enforcement. You're still going to have other law enforcement agencies that are associated with law enforcement. You still end up with an argument that they're taking care of their own. And that's kind of what the argument's been historically. And I understand that from a layman's standpoint, not knowing what our internal processes is and the scrutiny. I think our investigations and the scrutiny that we provide in those is much, much more. And I can tell you right now, the District Attorney of Oklahoma County will not hesitate to file a charge on somebody if he feels like it's justified. He's already proven that, so.
Other question here?
Chief City, I'm gonna go to a specific case, okay. But you made a statement earlier that you would not tolerate lies from anyone on the police force. And I'm going to the gentleman that raped the women on Northeast Side. My first part of the question was an internal affair investigation done to see what other officers knew about it. Because I asked that because I cannot believe that he raped that many women and some other officers did not know or were not a part of that scenario. Two, do you think it was just and fair that he should walk out on bond when if that had been an African American or Hispanic, he would still be sitting in that jail waiting to go before a judge?
Okay, there's no indication in our investigation, and I really have to give high praise to our investigators that did that case, because they really, as a result of their investigation, probably over half of those young women were found and actually he's being prosecuted for what he did to them. If they had not been aggressive and diligent and overturning every stone they could, those women never would have come forward on their own, because he preyed on women that would not come forward. That's how he got away with it for so long, until he finally had, you know, met a lady that really was strong and reported it and really set the ball rolling. So I there's no indication that there was any knowledge by any of their officers. If there was, we would certainly be dealing with that right now. The second part of your question is, one, we don't have control. The police don't have control over whether somebody bonds out. My opinion, and the opinion of most everybody I work around, is how does a serial rapist that raped 13 women have a bond so low that he's out at home? I mean, I agree with you 100%. I don't get it, and because he's a serial rapist.
Councilman, I want to ask you about that. Those serial rapes. Did that deepen the distrust of the police department?
Absolutely, yes. His last victim happened, the location, basically Northeast 50th and Lincoln, which was right close to my house. And I look at the age of the victim, and she was almost the same age as my mother. So you know that that touches home, that his victim could have been my mother. So I think that that does have a major role in whether or not African-Americans trust the police. But I think it also has another role, that here was Oklahoma City actually took the lead and arrested him. You know, they actually did an investigation on him. You have some departments in our country who would have never done an investigation on him. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, at the National Black Caucus of Local Black Elected Officials, and we spent half of the day talking about police relationships, and there were some stories that black elected officials across the country that they were sharing about their police department, where you had similar situations to occur where the police department didn't do anything about it. They had the proof, but at the end of the day, the DA didn't even touch it. But here's a case where the police chief and his officers, they went after him, and you know, and I'm definitely grateful that they went after him, because they could have been like some of these other municipalities across the country who just looked the other way, and that did not happen here. So you do have some bad distrust, but again, the police department did their job, and they went after him like he was a regular old person. Now, I don't agree with the officer receiving bail, and then what happens? He somehow ankle bracelet comes off, not just one time, but twice. Had that been an African American, that if it happened one time, his butt would have still been in county jail. He still would have been in there. Now, again, something happened twice. Now he's in there, but that goes to the overall legal system. Here's a cop who is a generational cop. His daddy was a cop. So knowing the ins and outs of law enforcement, that gave him a better hand in making sure he had the best attorney and whatever to argue whatever in court, that allowed the judge to say, okay, we'll set this bond at a lower amount. But had he been African American police officer, you best believe that bond would have been about $30 million, and there wasn't no way that black police officer would have been able to get that type of bond. Mm-hmm.
Hi, I'm Steve Mason. I think Councilman Pettit's actually spoke to a large degree about my question about the legitimacy of government. We need legitimate government. And the rape that we're discussing, which is an obvious crime, the city remains peaceful. And we see other cities where the crimes aren't as obvious across races and there's violence. Why do you think Oklahoma City remained peaceful?
Is that for me, Steve?
Whoever wants to take it.
I'll let you go first, Chief.
You know, I like to think that everybody's interested in having a peaceful community, regardless of where we live. I grew up here in Oklahoma City, and I don't care what color you are, what your status is. I like to think that we all have historically really tried to work together to come up with some, you know, really solutions to some of the issues, because we're dealing, obviously the issues are there for us just as they are with any other community. But I rode over here when I first became a young police officer. I rode the east side. I grew up in a white school. I grew up around white kids. I went to college with primarily white kids. And now I'm a cop and I'm in Northeast Oklahoma City. And it was a cultural shock for me. I mean, because there is a difference. But I really came to love the community, and regardless of what you see in the news, most people in those neighborhoods where violence is occurring are really good people, and they want peace too. They don't want to be terrorized by gangs. They don't want to be terrorized by somebody breaking into their house or drugs. They need help. They need law enforcement's help to do that. But I think the important thing is this department, and it doesn't, it's not just with me, it goes back to previous chiefs. It goes all the way back to, I can see pictures and read stories of Clara Looper when she was at the Katz drugstore, and police and Clara Looper were in a dialogue as to how that protest would occur and that it was going to be peaceful. And yes, people were going to go to jail, but it was going to be peaceful. And I like to think that we, historically, in Oklahoma, in Oklahoma City, that's the kind of people we are, and I really truly do believe that. And I think we, not that it just happens, because I think we work hard at it, but, I appreciate you bringing that up, because it's a good observation, because it doesn't happen. And it's things like this, people willing to talk about it and be open and realize that we do have things we can always work on, and we need to try to make things better, so.
Chief, I want to ask you, there are a lot of things outside of the police department's control, poverty, blight, educational challenges with schools, but there is one thing that affects residents that maybe the department can have some, or be at least be aware of, and that's the financial burden of the criminal justice system. I mean, fines and fees have skyrocketed. People come out of prison, buried in debt. Police officers are there to issue tickets, issue fines, arrest people for really minor charges that lead to all kinds of debt. So does your department operate with any awareness that that is an issue and that you can somehow adjust to recognize it?
Well, for one thing, the police department doesn't have complete control over fines and those types of charges. I mean, some of it's dictated by state law and regulated by state law. Mm-hmm. Then in the municipal courts, they deal with, they have a certain process that they have to have, and they have to pay for that process. So those tickets and those fines are commensurate with actually having to operate those types of, operate a court system or a prosecution. As far as minor offenses go, probably police officers are more cognizant of that on a daily, because I hear about it consistently, that an officer doesn't like writing a $170 ticket to a lady that's obviously not a criminal and is on Social Security, and they refuse to do that. But at the same time, we have an obligation. There's talk about de-policing or not policing some of the minor offenses and things like that, but I'm not a proponent of that. And I think that one of the reasons that we go back to the community really being safe overall is that we've always enforced some of the minor infractions, larceny, some of those types of things. Somebody may have broken your window. It's still a crime, and it still should not go. If you're the victim of that minor crime, you still don't want us to ignore that. And we shouldn't, because those minor crimes and those minor offenses in many cases end up being larger offenses if you're not addressing it. One of the issues, I think, in this state that's not ever talked about is our juvenile justice system. And a lot of those minor crimes are dealing with the youth. And getting youth into a juvenile justice system should be a positive. It shouldn't be a negative. It should be a positive. And we should provide the services and those types of things in dealing with that. Because you're absolutely right. I mean, you probably don't want me to talk about this, but I tell people, law enforcement is in many ways a scapegoat for this, our inability to address a lot of the social issues in our society, mental health. Mental health is a serious, serious problem, coupled with drugs, self-medication for the mentally ill. Those types of things are very, very serious, and we need help. We need help from our political leaders in addressing that. Now, I'm also cognizant that that costs money, and we don't always have it. But we have to decide where our priorities are in dealing with some of those societal issues. So I don't know if that answered your question, but.
Sure. Jenny has a question.
My name is Aisha Factory, and my question is, has the department considered employing a community policing model that has been effective in other areas such as Charleston, South Carolina?
Yes and no. Every community is different. Community policing means something different to everybody, depending on what what your community needs. You have to keep in mind, our community is 621 square miles. A community policing model here may look different than a community that's, you know, that's 200 square miles that they have to cover with the same number of police officers or with even more police officers, which is usually the case. So we have a large area to cover. Community policing, walking beats, doing those types of patrols are not an efficient way for us to be able to answer calls for service and deal with crime in Oklahoma City in many cases because of the amount of area that we have to cover with the number of officers that we have. If you look at our community per square miles, we have fewer officers per square miles than most communities just because of our size. That being said, we do have a lot more community policing efforts. I mean, there's a lot of things we do that fall into the category of community policing. We're in our schools. We have officers in every one of our schools working with the school system. We have a police athletic league that works with the school system and deals with working with kids to get involved in sports and character building. You know, if you look at the downtown area, not just Bricktown, but the entire downtown area that is growing in population and density, bike patrols, beats, those types of things are essential in policing, in providing that community policing. And in many ways, for us, community policing is more of an attitude also that we're going to do more of in training as a result of this 21st century policing and how we deal with people on calls and if we're able to take more time. Again, if you're running from call to call and you're busy, community policing becomes much more difficult to do because you can't take that time to try to develop solutions for a problem that may not be that serious to you, but is very serious to the person that maybe has been victimized. So yes, I mean, we do a lot of things involved. We have a truancy program that I don't know of any other major city that does it, where this city and the city manager is committed to putting officers in the schools to try to keep kids in school and to finish high school, because all the statistics show if they can finish high school, then they're less likely to be involved in gangs and crime. And so we really try to focus on that. And that truancy program is funded by the city to help the schools try to get kids and their families keep their kids in school.
We have a question over here. Right there? Oh, okay. We'll get to you next.
My name is Jason Lowe. I'm a local attorney and also a candidate for House District 97. The question I have for you today is, when folks come into my office, they have major complaints about the police, about police officers. One of the major complaints is either their money was stolen or they've been abused. What can you tell me to tell my clients? What can you tell everyone here as far as what are the specific process that goes along with a complaint? What is, who gets the complaint? When is it taken up? And so on. Furthermore, I have a second question for you. You discussed gang violence and how it impacts Northeast Oklahoma City. My major complaint as far as the gang file in Oklahoma City, the DA's office has what's called a gang file, where they have special prosecutors who prosecute gang members. The issue I have with the gang file is, if you're riding in a car with someone who is a gang member, say you're riding with your son, automatically, once you're stopped by a police officer, you're also in the gang file. So for example, if you're a 74-year-old mother is in a car with her son and she's pulled over and a police officer's job is to write her name down and do a background check, automatically that person is in the gang file. And when she's stopped, she's looked at in a certain way. Do you agree with that policy?
Well, it's not a policy and it's not really accurate. To be in the gang file, to be listed as a gang member, there has to be a number of identifiers, whether it's tattoos of a gang on your arm, whether or not you are one is if you're with them, but being with a gang member alone does not put you in a gang file or list you as a gang member. That's not the standards that we have. One of those would not do it. Now, if you were with multiple gang members, you had a tattoo of the Rolling 90s on your right arm, and you said, I'm a member of a gang, and let me tell you, most gang members admit to being gang members because they're proud of it. So the criteria is much more than just your grandmother's not listed as a gang member because she's riding with her grandson who happens to be a gang member. That's just not true. Now, for prosecution purposes, they also have to meet those certain number of criteria for us to be listed as a gang member. So it's pretty rigid. It's just not as simple as you stated it there.
We'll have our final question from this gal over here.
Sarah Baker, I actually have two questions. One is very quick, and the other I would actually like to hear from both of our guests tonight. To the police department, what percentage of officers in Oklahoma City currently use body cams, and when will it be 100%? The second question is, it went away. Do you support alternative sentencing, such as community service in lieu of monetary fines?
Okay, to the body-worn cameras, 0% right now. We're in fact, Tuesday, the council, it's going to council to approve our policy for body-worn cameras. We now are in a testing phase, or getting ready to go into a testing phase with three vendors on body-worn cameras to determine what vendor we want to go with as far as as far as providing those cameras. So it's a very lengthy process, and I mean we went through a lengthy process the last legislative session to try to get some legislation that basically dealt with body-worn cameras for open records purposes. And I'm really proud of the work that the legislators did as far as working with us to try to get something that's reasonable on both sides, which still makes us transparent and provide videos, but also allows us to not have to release it so quickly that it might interfere with an investigation that may be occurring. But we're going to start with 100 cameras this year. Once we do the wear testing for 30 days, then we're going to do 100 cameras to begin with, because we're still learning about the process. A lot of cities are, and I'm a firm believer in quality, not quantity. And I want to make sure we do it right and learn how to do it effectively and have the policies and procedures in place so that we do it right. So we'll do 100 cameras, and then we'll have to look at it the next year and the next year to see how much we can afford to add, how much, you know, the council's willing to add, because it's a very expensive program, extremely expensive. But ideally we want to have it on all of our field units, our first responder units. So the second question, as far as alternative sentence, absolutely, we don't do enough of that. You know, the number of people that are in prison don't need to be there. Now, there's violent criminals that need to be in prison. And I'm not saying that repeat offenders, even if it's just a burglary at some point, don't need to spend some time in prison. And I think there's things that we can do as far as providing services. The way the system has been set up is that somebody gets out of prison, and if they do their full time, they walk out the door and there's no supervision. I think that every person that walks out of the door of the prison system, regardless of what your sentence was or you did the full thing, should be on a probation in our program to help find a job, help get a driver's license, to try to help them, because they've been in prison, and help them become a productive citizen. We need to support that. It'll be a lot cheaper supporting that process than having them turn around and have to put them right back in. So alternative sentencing, I think, is both from a probation standpoint, a parole and probation standpoint coming out of the prisons, and the judges being able to have, but you gotta have programs to send them to. And that's the biggest problem, is having enough good programs to say, you know, I'm going to sentence you to this program versus putting you in jail, and you have to adhere to that or you'll go to prison. I mean, that prison still has to be in many cases over their head for them to do the things that are required of them. But yeah, I'm an advocate of alternative sentencing. Absolutely.
Councilman, just to follow up, what do you see and hear in terms of how families are affected when there are 85% serve your time laws and no supervision after release?
I definitely believe that we need more work release programs. Last week, I had the opportunity to visit Clara Waters again, which is right off of I-35, and they met with our COPTER director. Our COPTER is our public transportation system, and also myself about trying to get some type of form of transportation up to that facility so the people who are a part of their work release program so they can go work. Because when you are in county jail or when you are in prison, you are charged daily. They charge you for housing. They charge you for food. And especially in the state system, I mean, you come out on everybody, on the state big time. And so how can you support your family if you have a large bill from, for example, the state of Oklahoma for being in prison? So there has to be some type of balance. So I strongly support work release programs and also community sentencing. So those people who made some mistakes are able to fully have some type of form of rehabilitation. Because we talk about them going to find jobs, but you also have to talk about making sure that they have the necessary training as well. And also with that, make sure that there are employers who are willing to hire them. So I think it's a unique situation where I think we have to do more to address, because in Northeast Oklahoma City, we have a lot of people who are in the process of being released. When they get released from the state prisons, they go right back into the environment in that particular environment. So they need to have choices. So I definitely believe in work release programs and community centers. To address the police body cameras, I think the chief took a major step, and the police department took a major step in trying to figure out the whole body camera stuff. You have some municipalities across the country that have body cameras and some municipalities who refuse to have body cameras. But our police department took the necessary step a year or two ago to start that process of researching whether or not it would be good for the city. And then we have a supportive city council who supports body cameras, who supports accountability. And I do want to recognize we do have two council members who are present. Councilman Pete White is here, and then Councilman Mark Stonecipher here, as well as our city manager. And I can say I speak on behalf of the council as it relates to body cameras, because we want to make sure that there is accountability from that first time that officer interacts with the public. There should be some accountability, but I think we have to take it a little step further. Now, of course, Oklahoma City, we are leading the way for as police body cameras, but I do believe in the county jail that the guards need to have body cameras as well. So you have to take it a step further. You should be able to track what happens to an individual from the first contact until the last contact. So I know I'm getting into the county's business there, but since they're talking about building a new county jail, I think it should be a requirement for body cameras for the officers to have. The county officers to have body cameras, because we receive those calls. My son, a grandson, a daughter, a granddaughter was locked up and they got beat up by a guard. We get those type of calls. Well, that's technically county, even though Oklahoma City, we may have picked them up, but once they get to the county jail, that's the county. And so I think as we talk about a new county jail, we need to talk about the sheriff department having body cameras as well.
Thank you. Yes, I think the whole world is going to be on video before long and every minute of life, so it will not stop. And it does add a measure of accountability. Thanks for coming. Please give our guests a hand. Mm-hmm. And please check out OklahomaWatch.org on a regular basis and sign up for our weekly newsletter, and you'll get a heads up first on our latest stories and investigations.